Hello and welcome to the Around the Nation podcast for the week of Monday, October 5th, 2009. I'm Pat Coleman.
And I'm Keith McMillan.
And it was a week in which you could say the D3Football.com top 25 was perfect, or you could look at it a little more closely like Keith and I have done over the past day and a half or so, and remembered that just because everybody won last week, and all 25 teams did, there was nobody in the top 25 on a bye last week. That doesn't mean that we've got the perfect poll and that the poll is absolutely correct as any collection of 25 opinions can be. And I thought, Keith, maybe you and I would just kind of go through the top 25 and maybe see what the issues are, or, you know, where you think and where I think things look a little bit odd.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Let's do it.
All right. One of the things that comes to mind for me, this is week five, where this week's games will be pretty much the halfway point of the Division III football season, and I think that there are a couple of cases where we, and I use we as a voter block, although I'm pretty sure that you and I don't necessarily agree with some of the sentiments that or some of the votes I'm about to put out here, but I think we're clinging a little bit to last year's performances in a couple of instances, and one of the ones I wanted to spotlight right off the bat was Monmouth.
Well, that's a good place for where we don't necessarily agree either, because I have Monmouth higher on my ballot than they are in the general poll. And part of the reason for that, I think, is based on last year's performance, where they had a game against Wartburg, which they basically led most of that game and lost by two. And then Wartburg went on to push Whitewater into the fourth quarter, and everybody around the nation following knows that that Whitewater is the cream of the crop in Division III, along with Mountain Union, and you know, we like to toss Mary Harden Baylor in there as well. And if I felt like Monmouth sort of belonged on the same field with a team that belonged on the same field as Whitewater, then, you know, to me, they are a team that, even though they don't have the competition necessarily week in and week out, and that's something that we'll address when we start getting down, you know, to talk a little bit about Case Western Reserve and Wabash and teams like that. That last year's result does play into this year a little bit, and you try not to do that, you know, but when you don't have those games this season to give you a lot of insight into what they're doing, and I feel like Monmouth, probably one of the teams closest to a guarantee won't lose another game this season if they get past St. Norbert. That's really the big test for them pretty much from here on out. You don't have a lot of those tests week in and week out, where you have a team like Ohio Northern that's playing somebody good every week, then you know, it's harder to figure out where they stand among these other elite teams.
Here's my take on Monmouth. I think Monmouth is getting some credit for getting to the second round of the playoffs last year, and I think that in some sense we're kind of forgetting how they got to the second round. You know, they got there because they played Aurora, the champion of the Northern Athletics Conference, first year with an automatic bid for Aurora or for the conference. You know, and they also, the only reason that those two teams were playing each other was because the NCAA penny pinched the bracket, and instead of sending Monmouth out west to play, I think it was going to be Occidental, and Aurora out to play Willamette. Occidental and Willamette played each other as a 2 and a 3 seed in the first round, and Monmouth and Aurora played each other.
Yeah, that's a very sharp memory, Pat, because you're right. It should have been a different matchup in the first round, and that did advance Monmouth to the second round. But they had the quarterback back, and Alex Tanney, and he's somebody that really exploded onto the scene last year as a sophomore and has kept that offense rolling right into this season. They're scoring 50 points a game. They're giving up 5 points a game. And again, it's not against the strongest competition. You know, their best test will come here in the second half of the season, which will probably also throw Ripon in there. And they come actually back-to-back in the next 2 weeks, St. Norbert at home and then at ripping. And you know, to me, I'm always real big, especially in the beginning of the season, on returning players and returning starters, and especially if you have a star player returning. And I leaned toward Monmouth in that case. You know, you could probably make this a similar argument for Case Western, but when you have teams that they don't have the stretch of tough opponents that you know certain other teams that we'll discuss here in a few minutes will play week in and week out in these strong conferences, you do kind of have to make a judgment on them, whether they belong in that top five or do they belong in the 15s, and because these results sometimes they're not going to give you an opportunity to reevaluate everything, and that's sort of the key you and I both talk about all the time. These top 25 is not just moving teams up a slot every time somebody loses, but reevaluating the whole picture each week.
One other thing to go back to last year, I guess, a little bit on Monmouth is you mentioned that, yeah, they go toe-to-toe with Wartburg, and then, you know, using the transitive property of football, Wartburg, you know, takes Whitewater down to the wire. But one of the things that I like to say, and I know that you know that I like to say it, is it's not who you lost to, it's who you beat. And I just don't know who Monmouth's beaten.
That's true, and that's a perfect example, because I'm a big fan of that statement, Pat, that you make. And as we look at some of these other teams in the top 25, you know, they're beating the teams they're supposed to beat, and that's positive, that's a good thing. But at the same time, there are a lot more than 25 teams that can make that claim, especially at this point in the season. A lot of teams 5-0, 4-0, 3-1, 4-1, more than 25 of them. So how do you sort out which ones are the ones that belong in the top 25? Some people are doing it off name recognition or where they had everybody placed in the beginning, right? You know, if you had Cortland State in the top 10, and you know, even though they don't have a real strong win, they don't fit that maxim of it's who you beat, you know, because they've beaten Morrisville State, they've beaten Buffalo State, they lost to Kane, and then they've beaten Rowan, which I guess is a pretty decent victory. But if, you know, how does that stack up with somebody like Franklin, who won at Baldwin Wallace, who's beaten Trine, and who's beaten Defiance, and their loss is out of division loss. You can sort of maybe throw that away when you're ranking the Division III teams. You know, those are tough matchups to make. You sometimes have to make those value judgments using who you beat and not just the teams you played.
When you talk about you know, teams just basically kind of getting automatically promoted or having a spot on your ballot right now, which is based on where you started them, you think that's why Case Western has gotten so high in the poll? Because I'm struggling just as much with to see what Case has done this year as I was with Monmouth.
Yeah, and that's I mean, I understand that happens, and that's some people's philosophy. Is if Case Western started out at number 18, let's say, in the beginning of the year, and then eight teams lost in front of them, you know, over the course of 5 weeks, then they move up to number 10. But does that automatically make them the 10th best team in the country when their wins are Kenyon, Rochester, Oberlin, and Denison? So Rochester is a decent victory, but the other teams, not what we'd call a strong slate of opponents. And Case Western, you know, they're going to play like institutions. They're not going to go out and schedule you know, a national powerhouse, even though there might be one in the same state as them. You know, it's a difficult thing that we run into every year when we're working on these top 25s, because teams can only play who's on their schedule, but they do have some control over who they schedule. And if you want that recognition that comes with being in the top 25, you have to play good teams and beat good teams.
Yeah, one of the common comments I get, I think, often from parents who think that their son's team is underrated by us, we're saying you can't punish a team, they can only play who's on their schedule. And I turn that around and say the exact opposite to them. I said, well, why would I punish this other team that I'm voting for ahead of your favorite team just because this team happened to play a couple of teams that were pretty darn good?
Right, and that's the difference when you look at a slate. Say I'm trying to think. Linfield maybe is a good example early in the season, or Wheaton, I guess, is maybe another one. Who's
St. John's, there's a good one, where they've played now and beaten Bethel, they've beaten Concordia Moorhead, right? They've beaten a team from the WIAC and Wisconsin Eau Claire, and you're looking at their 5-0, and then you're looking at Case Western's 5-0 or Wabash 5-0. You know, that's the difference between number maybe 5-6 in the poll and being down in the teams.
And it's sometimes it's kind of a real thin margin. I was talking with the folks on the Wabash broadcast this weekend about, you know, putting together, for example, my preseason ballot, in which I had, you know, Mount Union, Whitewater, Mary Hardin, Baylor in those top three spots. And then I had a bunch of teams I wanted to kind of rank 10th, 11th, or 12th, but somebody has to be ranked fourth. And it's just, you know, there has to be a fourth best team out there. It wasn't the gap between number three and everybody else is gigantic. And I think that that second tier of teams has gotten a lot bigger than it used to be in the past.
Yeah, well, we've had this discussion before, though, Pat, where you get in the, you know, the number in the past sometimes had been around 8, 9, or 10, where you don't feel that this team you're ranking is the 8th best team in the country, or in your example's case, you don't feel like they're necessarily the 4th best team in the country, but somebody has to go in that 4th spot. You don't get to rank them, you know, I wish there was a way I could phrase it where, you know, you feel like 3 is like a value judgment, rather than they're just where they slot in the poll, you know. Somebody goes in that 4 slot, somebody goes in the 5 slot all the way down to the 25, and usually there is a bigger group of teams where you'd feel comfortable ranking in the 20s or in the late teens rather than, you know, for me, I'll give you a good example right now. On my ballot, I have Hampton Sydney. Now they're up in the teens for me, and they're up 5-0, they're off to a good start, and they've played great defense the past 3 weeks after giving up 40-some-odd points to Gettysburg. You know, they're a team from a middle conference, you know, capable of putting out a strong team. But do I feel like Hampton Sydney necessarily, yeah, I think they're capable of doing good things, but are they already a team that's in the discussion with the 15s in the country? You know, sometimes you have to slot a team, you have to slot somebody up that high.
Yeah. One of the other questions, I think, common questions we get about the poll is the sometimes inherent paradoxes. One of them, which I know you and I talked about earlier, was the fact that Ohio Northern beat North Central, you know, beat them, you know, significantly, not in a close game, or not in a, you know, not by a field goal, basically. And is now ranked behind them. North Central is 14, and Ohio Northern is 18.
Yeah, Pat, and the way you explain that, of course, is what have you done for me lately? If Ohio Northern started out the season with this victory over North Central, but then went on to lose its next two games against Mount Union and Otterbein, you know, there's one school of thought that says, well, you know, they may have been, in September 5th, week one, they may have been, you know, better than North Central, but based on what we've seen lately, you know, we don't necessarily believe that anymore. Then there's another school of thought, which I kind of subscribe to. This is if you have a head-to-head result, that supersedes almost everything else, and you can't. It's kind of messing up my poll now because I have North Central much lower than I tend to think they are strength-wise, especially when you consider that Wheaton is in the top 10, and then North Central. You know, you have to if I attach them to Ohio Northern because Ohio Northern is losing games, and I'm dropping them down my poll, and then I attach North Central to that and drop them down as well. It creates this space between North Central and Wheaton that maybe to me is a little artificial because I certainly could see them playing later in the season and North Central winning that game. But that's where the poll is sometimes, like you mentioned, a little bit of a paradox. The other thing I think that's difficult about about that same situation, Pat, is that you look at what Ohio Northern's done, and we talked about strength of schedule for some of the teams that haven't played strong teams. Now you've got Ohio Northern, or if you look at this week's poll, they have a win over number 14, which is North Central, then a loss to number 1, and a loss to number 13, which is Otterbein. And, Pat, this is another one of your theories that you like to bring up in the poll, is that when a team team loses to teams that are ranked ahead of it, then the poll is working correctly. And do you penalize a team for losing games to teams that are ranked ahead of it?
Right. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. I think a good example of that was this week when St. John's beat Bethel at home by less than a field goal, 16-14, and Bethel didn't move. You know, Bethel was – it probably could stand to be in the top 25. They're on my ballot. I'm not sure offhand how many others they are on, but you know, there have been we've had instances in the poll where teams have moved up with a close loss, and in this case, Bethel standing still. Whereas I think in a lot of other polls, anybody who loses is automatically dropped down, no matter what happens.
Yeah, and I think there's a limit to how long you can do that, because for Bethel, I agree that, you know, they're right now they have a loss to number 4 Wheaton on the last play of the game, and they have a 2-point loss against number 6 St. John's. So, you know, there's teams that are ranked in single digits right now that won't play one team that strong the rest of the season, and now we have Bethel who's belonged right on the field, been in the game and down to the last minute against number 4 and number 6 in the country. And sometimes you learn more as a voter from loss, or you feel like you do, than you do from a victory. But you have to draw that line somewhere, because in the case of Hardin-Simmons, they might have played now 5 teams stronger than some teams have played at all this season. You know, if you put, just to use Case Western Reserve as an example again, the 4 teams they've beaten and the 5 teams that Hardin-Simmons has played, 4 of which they've lost to. You know, all the teams that Hardin-Simmons have played, it might be better than the best team Case has played so far. And but you do have to draw the line somewhere. You can't really rank a 1-4 team ahead of a 4-0 team, can you?
Yeah, probably not. But I had to think about that for a second. I might depend on the 4-0. You know, I might be able to look down the up and down the standings and find a 4-0 team that I would be willing to put behind Hardin-Simmons. I just don't know if I could find, you know, however many teams, what it would be, 213 that I would have to rank behind Hardin-Simmons for them to get on my top 25 ballot. Probably not going to happen.
Yeah, but again, you meant the case of Bethel is a really good example in this case. Like we said, could very well have beaten Wheaton and St. John's, teams that right now are ranked 4th and 6th in the country. So, you know, does that mean Bethel doesn't belong on the ballot? You know, they're so far from number 4 and number 6 that they don't belong anywhere. You know, that's the choice that each individual voter has to make. And Pat, you know, if we haven't learned anything from this much of the podcast so far, it's that, you know, polling is a little bit of an art and a little bit of a science.
Yeah, I mean, because we've, in the course of this conversation so far, we've contradicted ourselves. We've just talked about Bethel, who hasn't, you know, beaten a team in the top 25. And not 5 minutes ago, we were talking about Monmouth in terms of it's not who you lost to, it's who you beat. I think in this case, it's going toe-to-toe with two separate teams, I think, helps Bethel's case. In my mind, it's knowing that, you know, Bethel is going to schedule those teams and they're going to see teams like that on a regular basis in their conference, and then going out and scheduling somebody strong outside of conference, and I think that's where the kind of difference between those two teams is.
Yeah, I agree with you on both those counts, and I also, this is one thing I look for. A game that very well could have been a victory. Okay, in Bethel's case, you know, they didn't beat Wheaton, they didn't beat St. John's, but when you're one play away, one defensive stop, one drop pass against Wheaton, what have you, if a game is tight late in the fourth quarter and it's less than one score, that's a game that Bethel very well could have won. I'll give you another example of a team that's not really on anybody's top 25 ballot at this point, but is a team that you got to keep on the radar just for later in the season. Millsaps now has lost by 3 to Mississippi College and just lost this weekend to DePaul in a very tight game. But if they somehow finish the season 8-2, you know, they're going to be a team that, depending on what DePaul and Mississippi and Trinity and Center and all the teams that Millsap plays, depending on what they do, you know, that's another team that could hang around the end of the top 25 by the end of the season, because they
Right, because because in essence, what we're doing is we're taking 238 teams and we're making that judgment every single time because there's so little head to head. The division is so large. The NCAA actively suppresses interregional play. So you know, when I'm doing my ballot, I'm looking, you know, would Willamette beat Case Western Reserve? You know, those are the kind of questions that I ask kind of up and down the ballot. And you know, a week like this where I didn't have to change anything on my ballot if I didn't want to was a perfect opportunity to kind of ask all those questions again and reevaluate where everybody stood.
Yeah, and that's, you bring up two interesting points. One is reevaluating, you know, doing that really from top to bottom. And you kind of do it every week. Well, not every week, because this week wasn't a good example of it, but weeks when teams lose, four or five teams lose, and then somebody, doesn't give you the result you thought you might see, then you maybe reevaluate the teens or the 20s. Sometimes you got to reevaluate the whole thing, top to bottom. And, the other good point that you bring up is that there isn't necessarily a lot of cross competition, but when you get 5 weeks in the season, Pat, and we've talked earlier in the season on some of these podcasts about not having enough data in, and now we're at the point where we have some data in, and you have a result, you know, especially in the Northeast, in New York, where a lot of conferences overlap, in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, where teams will play teams from other conferences, but geographically, those are short trips, so those when they play non-conference games, those teams will play each other. You know, an example I have is, I didn't write this one down, see if I can do it off the top of my head, but Kane, right, is beating Cortland State, and Delaware Valley beating Kane, right, Wesley, is it Wesley beating Delaware Valley?
Yep.
You know, I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that you can go from Cortland State all the way up in New York. There's probably going to be, when they play Ithaca at the end of the season, there'll be another result from the Empire 8. You can go from the Empire 8 to the NJAC to the MAC to Wesley, the Atlantic Central, and at some point you will have a good group of overlapping results for some of the teams you vote for. And then Pat, you have that other group where you're trying to compare, like you said, Case Western and Willamette, and there's no result in there that helps you sort that out.
You know, one other thing that happened this weekend, Keith, is that you and I each got to go out and see top five teams, live and in person. And I was hoping to get your kind of take on Wesley.
Yeah, well, the thing that really stood out to me about Wesley is that, you know, they have elite talent. You can tell when you watch them play, and that's the type of team that if they wanted to, they can coast and beat a lot of teams because they're fast. You know, they're solid up front. They're strong. They have a quarterback now in Shane McSweeney that's in his second season. You know, he's efficient passing the ball. He's willing to run the ball. You know, he'll scramble. He doesn't necessarily not the type of quarterback that wants to slide. He likes to take players on when he runs the ball. So they have a guy who's a good leader out there, who's a good inspiration, and then they have. They're so deep. You know, they lost their top running back, Aaron Jack, the high ankle sprain, didn't play this weekend. And then Abib Badness, the backup, he strained his groin during the game, so then he didn't play. So they had their first two running backs were down, and they've been giving carries to five guys this season. So they had three other running backs they could bring in. Lost one of their best defensive ends, actually on a special teams play against Delaware Valley, Josh Nevitt, defensive end, tore his ACL, and he's out. But since Wesley already rotates eight players on the defensive line, it wasn't as devastating an injury as it might have been to a team that doesn't have that kind of depth. And when you see a team with that kind of talent, not just in their starting lineup, but down the roster, you know, that's the type of team that we'll see in the playoffs. Has potential to go deep in the playoffs, but there's a difference, Pat, and you can talk about having seen Mount Union this weekend. There's a difference when you watch Mount Union play, and then you watch another really good team play on a different week, Pat. You can see the difference in the level of execution.
Absolutely, and I did see Mount Union play, and those people who are watching the poll very closely noted that I'm sure that Mount Union lost one of its first place votes this week. They went from 23 to 22. I'm going to come right out and say that was my first place vote that I switched over, and here's why. The Mount Union that I saw on Saturday night, measured against Mount Union standards, needs some work, I think. And I'm not going to say, I'm not going to, you know, pretend that I know anything that Mount Union doesn't already know. You know, the running game is, you know, is has some questions still. I think the quarterback play, you know, they're rotating between Kurt Rocco and Neil Seaman. Neil Seaman, true freshman. Rocco, a senior who's been on the bench for 3 years, waiting behind a succession of quarterbacks in front of him. You know, Rocco gets two out of every three possessions, and Seaman gets the third, is basically how it's been broken down so far. And the guy who's the best quarterback on the roster is playing wide receiver still. So, you know, the I think the offense still is trying to figure itself out. Baldwin Wallace actually basically shut Cecil Shorts out for the first 20, 22 minutes of the game. Also, the Baldwin Wallace defense did a good job getting pressure on Rocco, you know, for the first quarter and a half or so, before one of their defensive ends got hurt. You know, so, you know, I think that, of course, the defense for Mount Union was just stellar. Held Baldwin Wallace off the scoreboard. Baldwin Wallace just couldn't get anything done offensively all night, basically. The defense isn't the question. The reason why I felt that I would put Whitewater number one on my ballot was because, you know, they lost a little bit less than Mount Union did. And seeing Mount Union up close and in person made me realize that those two key pieces, starting quarterback and starting running back for Mount Union, the guys that they had to replace, I think that's still a work in progress. And I thought that it just wasn't up to Mount Union number one standards when I had a 1A in Whitewater that was basically ready to go.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Pat, because, you know, I was saying about how there's a level of execution that the elite teams tend to have. And, you know, Mount Union really has had it over the course of several years now. And last year, you know, I thought they would drop off a little bit, because even though they had Greg McKaylee back at quarterback and Nate Kmick at running back, they had so many other starters to replace. I think they only had 8 starters back last season. I thought that would be more trouble for them. Turns out, as you observed over the weekend, that maybe having the quarterback and the running back in place is actually, you know, more of a, or having to replace those two is actually sometimes more trouble than having to replace that whole other line.
Mount Union punted, Keith. They punted twice in their first 4 possessions. They punted on their first possession of the second half as well. You know, the scores that they got, their first 2 scores were a field goal. It was an 8-play, 13-yard drive, and then a touchdown on a 6-play, 26-yard drive. They had one sustained drive in the first half. It wasn't like I was watching Mount Union football.
Yeah, but that standard that they've built up over time, and Whitewater certainly does it as well. And, you know, we've seen other elite teams have that sort of standard of execution from week to week, and you just know it when you're watching an elite team, and they don't put the ball on the ground, they don't let a lot of pressure get on their quarterback. You know, the penalties are kept to a minimum. Those are the type of things that elite teams do, and when a team like Wesley takes the field and they have that elite talent, and they can sort of, you could tell if they put it all together, that they would be able to compete potentially with any other team in the country. You know, I think that's what I saw this Saturday at Wesley. You know, maybe the deepest Wesley team I've ever seen, and they have a real special talent at wide receiver and a guy named Ellis Kraut who was on the Oregon Ducks roster at some point, and a 6'4" receiver, but not one-dimensional. You know, he's not somebody that they will throw the fade to him when they get close to the goal line because the guy's 6'4". But he could do more than just jump and come down with the ball. And we've seen teams, you know, recruit guys from the basketball team and just think, hey, this guy's going to be a great wide receiver. There's a little more to it than that, and Ellis Kraut is pretty polished in the sense that he blocks on run plays, and if he gets the ball in open space, he can make tacklers miss. So he does kind of have that total package. And, you know, similar to Mount Union having Cecil Shorts, having a special explosive talent on the field, you know, can help you win games when you're struggling elsewhere in your offense, or you're not playing your sharpest game. Sometimes you can just go to that guy and he can bail you out. And I think Weston was able to do that a little bit on Saturday against Frostburg State. And for Wesley, they're not going to get that many more opportunities this season to really get pushed and get tested. So they have to be sort of like a self-motivated team where they want to play every week just to play as well as they can play. And not just until they make the score big enough where they don't have to worry about losing, but to do it because they got to get better. Because other teams, when they start getting deep into the playoffs, teams are going to devise ways to try to take Ellis Crowd out of the game, whether it's, you know, bracketing him underneath with a cornerback and a safety over the top. They're going to have to be a little more creative on offense, and they're going to have to be very sharp with their execution. And that also means not getting penalties, of which they had a couple silly ones on Saturday.
This has been more of an analysis podcast than it has been a news podcast this week. We covered a ton of games on the front page on Saturday, so if you're looking for more about your favorite game, you know, we had so many games of interest out there that we actually broke the front page story up into two parts, one with all the top 25 teams and one with everybody else, you know, where Ursinus and Gettysburg combined for, you know, three-quarters of a mile of total offense. Trinity, Connecticut rallies to beat Williams. All those things, you know, we've got out there. We elected to focus solely on the top 25 this week because we had the unusual happening with the top 25 going 25-0 this past week. And then, you know, coming up next week, we've touched on a couple of the big games already. The battle between Monmouth and St. Norbert in the Midwest Conference should answer some questions. Mount Union goes to Capital in a battle of unbeaten teams. If that means anything to Mount Union, facing another unbeaten team, I don't know. Whitewater is facing Eau Claire, Mary Hart and Baylor, Louisiana College, Dickinson is facing Johns Hopkins, but basically, we're right at the midpoint of the season. The conference races are going to heat up, and that's where we're looking at for the next week.
Yeah, and this is where it gets fun, because you and I both love the non-conference games where you see a Harden Simmons go out to Whitworth or Linfield or something like that, or you see a team from Wisconsin go down to Texas and play, and that's fun. But when you get into these conference races and it's sort of like it's almost like, you know, a round robin type of deal where somebody's getting eliminated every week and then somebody else loses the next week and suddenly the race gets interesting again. You know, we're looking at a lot of situations this year. You can name off the top of your head, if you really wanted to, four or five conferences that you don't know who the leader is right now. You don't know who the contenders are going to be because they have three or four teams that are very capable of winning that automatic bid, and that's what's going to be so fun to watch pretty much from week six on.
That wraps up our Around the Nation podcast for this week. Don't forget to check back later in the week. Statistical Spotlight coming up later tonight, Monday night, Around the Region on Tuesday. I'll have a Q&A with Eric Rayburn, the Wabash head coach, on Wednesday, Keith's Around the Nation column on Thursday, and then Friday and Saturday's game coverage.